Hello, Toby. This is Shirley Willer. I'd like to first make a request for Marion. She would prefer that you use the name Meredith Gray in your paper, as she does have a family who is unaware of her orientation. You ask for a short profile of us. Mine may not be so short, as I do not dislike talking about myself. I was born in 1922 in Chicago, Illinois, of what would now be called middle-class parentage. My ancestry was Austrian-German. My parents were somewhat, quote, advanced, end quote, for their age. You might say that I was always an upfront lesbian. That is, as soon as I recognized my sexual orientation for what it was. My first truly repressive experience was rather in the area of women's rights when in high school I discovered that there were separate lists of majors that students could select from when they were planning their careers, one for girls and one for boys. When I objected, they firmly insisted that I select one from the girls' list. It would be best for me. With much rebellion, I selected that which I felt would give me the most freedom and money-earning ability. My choice was not impossible, since as a registered nurse, I was able to move freely about the country, always assured of a rapid acceptance in the working world. I was always a sexual being, precocious, you might say. Having had sexual experiences with men even before my 16th year, this, however, always lacked the element of importance to me. I truly felt that I had no capacity for love. Many years later, I discovered that my strong desire for the presence of and physical contact with women was not the usual, but the unusual. That, in fact, there were but comparatively few of us who had this gift, and that its name was homosexuality. Can you today envision a world in which, in a well-read family, there was no material which contained either the word homosexual or lesbian, much less any description or discussion of the phenomena? There was so little information available, even in later years, that I was suspended from one of the nursing schools I attended as a lesbian, even though at that time I was not aware of my own orientation. I just felt that the rest of the women in the school were being silly to waste so much of their time on men, when there were other things of more interest in the nurse's residence. It was still later that I encountered the information that revealed me to myself. With great excitement, I hurried home to my family and informed them proudly that I was gay. Although stunned, there was never any rejection of me by my family or friends. I gather this was a rare exception to the experience of both the gay men and women of my time. I went through the usual processes of trying to conform, mainly as a matter of practicality in the world of the 1940s. But when the mental health psychiatrist irritatedly said, "Tell her to let her hair grow, get out of that woman's dorm and find herself a man," I walked out with the resolution that she was an inflated bag of nonsense, and in living my life, I would do it my way. This has been my practice ever since, and I've never regretted it. I've never made my sexual orientation a secret, either in my profession or in my private life. If anyone could not accept me as friend or employee, as my total self, I did not need either their companionship or their job. I may mention that I've never lost a job, either for this or any other reason. Being without worry about financial security led me to move freely about the country, living and working for many years in most of the major cities across the United States. My life has been full of joyful experiences, which of recent years I've been more and more aware. Now to my entrance into the homophile revolution. You must be aware that prior to 1950, there were no organized groups of homosexuals anywhere in the country. I understand that the first organization was a secret society called first the Circle of Friends, which became the first Mattachine Society. They began around 1952 to print a magazine called One. My first encounter with the concept of organization was when one of my many male homosexual friends gave me some copies of that magazine. Enthusiastically, I both subscribed to the magazine and sought out all of their previously printed copies. This was about the time they were having their historic battle with the United States Post Office. There were, however, no activities or meetings of any kind that I could discover in the city of Chicago where I was at that time. Thus, my only participation in any active way remained in the future when I moved to New York City. As an aside, I would like to give you, if possible, a picture of the life of a lesbian during my youth. It was a time of role-playing. You were either a butch or a femme. The butch wore clothing as masculine as possible, if not men's clothing. The femme had to outdo the most feminine of women. My experience being limited in the social area of lesbian activity, I frequently encountered suspicion among lesbians, the people I most wished to associate with. I was even suspected of being a police spy. Thus I tended to assume the coloration of the time, becoming more and more masculine in my dress and actions for the purpose of achieving acceptance. Much of this veneer has been impossible to remove, even today, although I've never desired or approved of such role-playing. You will find this true among many of the women of my age, who may or may not like it. We had to live with it. The only organized activities that were available to us at that time were things such as softball teams, bowling teams, and the annual Halloween balls, which were the huge, grandiose event of the year, planned all year from year to year and held in the largest and swankiest ballrooms in the city. I had a large association among the gay men in the city, partially because of my acquaintance with many male nurses. One of the reasons I became militant in my desire for organized rebellion against society's attitudes concerns one of these male nurses. Barney was a charming young farm boy type who was working nights as a male nurse and going to school at the same time, hoping eventually to get his engineering degree. Our working hours at that time were usually 12-hour shifts. While waiting for a friend to pick him up one day, driving to school, Barney fell asleep on his couch with a cigarette in his hand. When the friend arrived, the couch and Barney were two-thirds burnt. He was taken to a neighboring hospital for treatment. The hospital was run by an order of Catholic brothers who would not allow any women as visitors, patients, or nurses. My male associates formed a volunteer group and specialed Barney throughout his stay there. Our fears and hostilities were aroused when we realized that Barney was receiving only minimal care, narcotics and little else. When our men objected, they were told, "Well, it doesn't really matter. You see, he's one of those." We immediately went to the Veterans Hospital and asked for a transfer for him. It took some discussion since we were the only family that Barney had, but they agreed to move him. They did, 3 days later. That night, Barney died, and so did a little of all the rest of us. I don't think that will ever quit hurting. Somewhat later, a year or so, word was passed that there was going to be a meeting of people discussing formation of an organization, presumably the Daughters of Bilitis. Although I had never heard of them, it sounded as though it might be what I was looking for. I attended the meeting, which was rather vague, chaired, as far as I could tell, by a man who was a stranger to me, and some of the various problems of homosexuals in general were discussed. I was disappointed in that it did not seem to lead to any activity, and to my knowledge, there was never another meeting called. I did, however, obtain a name and address in New York, which was supposed to be of an active and working chapter of the Daughters of Bilitis. I was not aware of the Mattachine Society and its work, or I might have had a completely different future ahead. My mother, who had worked for about 25 years at the State Mental Hospital in Chicago, had finally become too ill to continue in her job. I persuaded her to move to Florida, where her sisters and brother lived, bought her a home, and returned to Chicago long enough to liquidate our place there and prepared to move to New York. Among the first things I did upon my arrival in New York was to write to the Daughters of Bilitis. I received in return a most gracious letter inviting me to attend a meeting of the group the following month. I could hardly wait. When the appointed date arrived, I somewhat trepidatiously sought out the address. The meeting convened and discussion began about, of all things, the wording of a brochure for the Daughters and how they might phrase or rephrase the purpose of the Daughters of Bilitis. Somewhat disappointed in the work being done, I did not realize that in the near future I would experience the utmost in frustration because of the limitations imposed by that document and by the bylaws of the organization. I looked for a rebellion, a revolution, and I discovered a social club devoted to self-help, consultations with psychiatrists in the church, endless programs of self-analysis and reassurance to women who needed their hands held. And yet, I was working with women, lesbians. And perhaps it might be possible someday to do the work I felt needed doing. The New York Daughters appointed me chapter treasurer within 3 months of my joining the group to fill out the term of one of our chapter who became ill. And within the year, I had been elected chapter president. This involved necessary daily work of writing, typing, mailing out the newsletter, counseling the fearful, doing the office housekeeping, arranging financing for office and party space, giving talks to college groups, appearing on radio and television programs, pursuing research people to ensure inclusion of the female viewpoint, and on and on. Directly after my first meeting of the Daughters of Bilitis, I also joined the Mattachine Society of New York. I was asked to run for office in Mattachine several times, but I felt committed to the Daughters and hoped to see them assume their proper place in the coming revolution. There were, however, a sad lack of rebels. I felt I was promoting the best interests of the Daughters by doing everything I could to assist in the formation of an affiliation of all of the homophile organizations on the East Coast. This resulted in ECHO, the East Coast Homophile Organization, which became the foundation of the North American Conference of Homophile Organizations. Throughout my years of working with the Daughters, I was a member and frequently held office of some kind in every homophile organization on the East Coast, as well as a few on the West Coast, and also Midwest Mattachine in Chicago. Please do not feel that I was unsympathetic with the lonely and or fearful lesbian who was having difficulties with self-acceptance, as well as personal identity problems. I sympathized, but did not identify with such a person. I did not feel myself to be an appropriate individual to give assistance, since I had no such experience myself. Also, it seemed a little too similar to the way I spent my days. Few people realize that the nurse is continually besieged by just this problem every day in every way by every patient, male or female. Apparently, I was able to conduct this portion of my duties as a DOB officer satisfactorily on most occasions, despite my hidden, I hoped, feelings, since that seems to be the facet of my work best remembered by most DOB women. We did try to conduct the chapter affairs as close to the guidelines as propounded by the Statement of Purpose and by the bylaws as our own personalities would allow. We attempted to assist in educating the lesbian, the public, provided the necessary forum, and so forth. We participated in and sought out research projects, and even conducted classes for student psychiatrists from the medical schools. For an extended period of time, we were able to secure financial security for not only the New York chapter, but for the latter and the other chapters of DOB as well. But we were anxious to move into the emerging women's rights movement. We wished greater participation in the activist future, which was beginning to appear upon the scene. I became convinced that the only way we could continue to contribute satisfactorily to the benefit of the group was to encourage autonomy for the individual chapters, maintaining a loose affiliation of these groups for the purpose of exchange of information and mutual moral support. It was on this platform and under this proposition that I ran for and was elected national president. We wanted to do much more than conduct parties and Gavin Javas. Nevertheless, I was unsuccessful in showing the desirability of the changes we proposed to the general membership. The Western chapters felt that we wished to destroy the organization. Our own chapter was in a state of flux after my election as national president, since we had withdrawn our usual labor from the group and tried to encourage new leadership. But the new leadership had to establish its own authority. I've been looking through your questions, and there appear to be a few that need elaboration. You ask whether the themes and directions I pursued as chapter president reflected those of Dell, Phil, and National, whether either of us influenced each other, whether or not there were tensions between the West Coast leaders and the East Coast leaders, and so forth. You phrased this in two separate places, so it must be of some importance to you. I do not know whether or not the West Coast leaders feared the independent size and autonomy of the New York chapter or not. I do know that we seldom agreed on priorities. As chapter president for too many years, I felt completely restricted by the restraints placed upon the actions of my chapter and myself. This naturally caused a great feeling of tension on my part. These tensions were both general and specific, and too numerous to mention. It appeared that the West Coast viewed the New York chapter as a good method of funding the activities of the organization in all of their activities, without giving the New York group the necessary authority to conduct its own affairs. The fact that I was one of the initiators of ECHO was viewed with great alarm. The daughters were not to join any other organization without permission of the governing board. Naturally, the West Coast leaders approved only of those organizations they were anxious to become involved with. With many an explanation that ECHO was an affiliation of organizations, not an organization in itself, I was able to continue to participate in its activities until the summer of 1965. We never opposed the participation of New York DOB in the demonstrations. We simply could not allow formal participation of the chapter in any activity not approved by the board. You may be unaware that the Central and Western Conferences, as well as the NACHO, were the result of ECHO and its conferences. Both of the two conferences, Central and Western, honored me by inviting my attendance and participation in my own person, rather than as a representative of DOB. After my election to the National Presidency of DOB in 1966, we naturally reinitiated the formation of the renamed Eastern Regional Conference. I'm sorry, Toby. Although I feel that I contributed in some way to the homophile movement, I'm afraid that I was ahead of my time in DOB. I ended my time with the organization with great sorrow and bitterness that the women of the Daughters were unable to assume the objective outlook necessary to advancing their place in both the homosexual and heterosexual communities. I had personally overcome the handicaps of discrimination against being both a woman and a lesbian, and was unable to comprehend why an organization could not get busy and do the same. The 1968 meeting of NACHO was to me the true beginning of gay lib. At that conference, there were many new, young, strong, activist organizations which wanted to see accomplishments other than discussion and the exchange of information. The original scope of the conference. Through their efforts, in which I joined, the scope of the conference was greatly changed. By that time, however, it was too late for me. I had reached the time when it was necessary to pay attention to my own health and future. As for DOB, in 1968 at the General Assembly, they rejected our proposals for reformation of the organization, amendment of the Constitution and bylaws allowing chapter autonomy, and otherwise effaced the work we had done during the previous 2 years. In 1970, the national organization Daughters of Bilitis was dissolved. I did not attend that meeting and can give you no further information following 1968. Toby, I would not like you to operate under the misapprehension that Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin were the restrictive element in the development and growth of the Daughters chapters. It was a membership itself which rejected any change. Phil and Del were, to my knowledge, the first upfront lesbians who became involved in the women's rights movement. They early joined as a couple, a privilege before that reserved to man and wife. Their example was not, however, followed by the membership of the organization. I do believe there was some suspicion on their part, Phil and Del's, that the New York chapter officers were not quite as reliable as those West Coast people with whom they were well acquainted. This did cause some difficulties, but not as many as they were blamed for. Don't you think so, Marion?
Oh, surely. The special onus on Phil and Del arose from the general membership's need for a great womb somewhere out west that would accept their collective responsibilities and resolve their guilts. Phil and Del were just convenient names.
To be completely honest, it was the vote of the New York chapter itself, as well as the influence of Western people, which prevented the Daughters from participating in public demonstrations as a chapter. True, there were always a few who could understand the need to get out there and fight, but the majority were afraid. The structure of the National Governing Board was a completely inoperable system. No small group of people concentrated in one area or scattered over the entire country could possibly envision the problems and situations in the individual areas. No member of the San Francisco chapter could see the priorities of the members in New York. Autonomy was necessary. With autonomy, freedom of each group to act as needed, when needed, with mutual support of each other's actions rather than criticism, the Daughters could have grown more and more. There are still chapters or organizations of the Daughters of Bilitis in many cities of the United States, and they do appear to be doing very well. I only regret that they are denied the support of each other as a national organization. I'll return for a short while to the period before I was elected national president. Within the permitted framework of activities of a chapter, one of the few that I found useful were those pertaining to education. The task of educating the lesbian was an ongoing, everyday activity which was done automatically and without planning. Our thrust was to the outside world, to reach the public in its every segment, the churches, the medical association, the educational system, political system, and so forth. To do this, we used every facility and every contact we could discover, and I believe that we were unusually successful. By seizing every opportunity, friendly or hostile, we were able to expand our outlets of information farther and farther. Every public showing of every kind produced new invitations to appear. We always agreed. Even on my last appearance as national president, I participated in a television show in Chicago at the 1968 NACHO meeting. This appearance did produce an amusing result. My family, as I told you, has been aware that I was a lesbian as long as I have. However, we never felt it necessary to inform my brother-in-law, since he appeared to be a typical WASP, and it might have caused unnecessary difficulties. Thus, when it was arranged that I appear on the Chicago show, I called my sister and suggested she break their television for that night. She was not much concerned, which was just as well. For several nights before my scheduled appearance, Bob, her husband, was reading the newspaper and suddenly called loudly, "Hey, Doris! Shirley's going to be on TV Wednesday!" There in the paper was a quarter-page advertisement with my name in one-inch letters as one of the nation's foremost lesbians. They did watch the program, and Doris' report to me was that my brother-in-law was simply very proud. He has never mentioned the matter to me, but it is good to know. You ask about the influence of the Negro Civil Rights Movement on our activities in the chapter and on our attitudes. I was an early member of the NAACP, but this was before the Selma March and other important liberation activities. By the time these occurred, I was already involved in the Daughters of Bilitis, and you can only invest your time and abilities in a limited number of directions. One of my concerns about the New York chapter was our inability to attract and hold any number of black or Spanish descent members. There again, I failed. The first interest of our black lesbian friends had become their blackness, not their sexual orientation. So the activities of the daughters were not able to fulfill their needs adequately, and we lost them. One unpleasant recollection pertains to the time we were invited by a prominent representative of a Washington, D.C. woman's group.
Sure, may I interrupt here? Because it might be of some interest to recall that the first activity of the New York chapter of the Daughters of Bilitis was to contact Lorraine Hansberry, author of Raisin in the Sun. We were seeking her assistance to obtain discount tickets for her Broadway hit. It was also the maiden flight, as it were, of Miss Barbara Giddings and Meredith Grey into the public relations field. Miss Hansberry at that time lived in an apartment high above the captain's table in Greenwich Village. The hallway of that building is decorated with themes from Jack and the Beanstalk. And we climbed and climbed higher and higher till we were about the top of the beanstalk, knocked on the door of Miss Hansberry. During her cordial discussion with us, Miss Hansberry reaffirmed her view that personal freedom and freedom from discrimination for the homosexual as well as for blacks would continue to receive her support. However, her business agent had advised her that open support of the homosexual would adversely affect the black civil rights movement and would be most untimely. Miss Hansberry felt that there was about to be a major development in the black civil rights movement. She asked us to be patient.
Miss Hansberry was correct in her evaluation of the situation of that time, because the incident I've been relating about the prominent representative of the Washington, D.C. Women's Group, not NOW, illustrates it perfectly. We were asked to meet with her for a discussion of women's rights. During the discussion, she made it clear that their group could probably get strong support for the women's equal rights bills if they could deliver votes against the Negro rights bills then being considered. The proposal apparently came from some of the Southern members of Congress who felt they could enhance their reputation as liberals while not alienating their Southern supporters. Our response was politely noncommittal. We were a women's group interested in the rights of all lesbians, regardless of color. She apparently got the point, as we did not hear from that group again. The Spanish Americans were a different kind of problem. The familial background of any Spanish girl has always emphasized the importance of the male, the need for machismo, the subservience of the female. In addition to the language barrier, which was a real problem, even the liberated lesbian of Spanish descent was still subject in her liberation to the concept of male dominance and usually found profound role-playing a necessity. Since the daughters attempted always to dissipate this attitude, the organization did not fill the image needed by these women. The same situation applied to the female transvestite. Although we tried to make them welcome and comfortable, our failure to accept them as men and our concept of them as women tended to destroy their own self-image. More failures. I was impatient with the DOB concentration on the reinforcement of the fearful, the maladjusted, the lonely little lesbians in the boondocks, a saying frequently used to describe the lesbian in small towns, the lace curtain lesbians, the female form of the closet queen, the repeated discussions we had to participate in of how I came out, and more of the same. I wanted to do something, probably burn my bra, or better yet, my high heels. There was, though, no avenue within the framework of the daughters, or in fact, any of the homophile organizations of that time, where this kind of upfront, somewhat violent demonstration could be carried out. All I could do was to work with what we had and wait. During the years I served in DOB, we managed to facilitate the formation of many organizations, many of them not chapters of DOB, but still organizations concerned with the rights of the homosexual, preferably with the problems of women. Among these was a Philadelphia chapter of the Daughters of Bilitis, which I felt was particularly my own. During my introduction speech to the fairly large group that attended, I managed to get carried away and spoke my mind a little more bluntly than was appropriate for a representative of the daughters. They did form under the primary framework of the daughters, but soon broke out of the ranks and produced the Philadelphia Homophile Action League, whose work the entire country has been forced to recognize as outstandingly productive. I believe that their access to Barbara Giddings as advisor and supporter must have contributed greatly to their success. You will realize by now that contrary to the philosophy of the Daughters of Bilitis, I had every desire for the lesbian to initiate active protest against our persecutors, and had no inhibitions against working in affiliation with male groups. My unadvertised desire was for the lesbian to take the lead in public action for the welfare of both male and female homosexuals. While the majority of the daughters felt that quiet invasion of the heterosexual world was most desirable and to adjust the lesbian to society was necessary. In my work with the gay organizations, I inevitably encountered many instances of male chauvinism. This always called forth for me a somewhat noisy public confrontation of the benighted individual, and immediately brought strong support from the more enlightened men of the gay community. By judicious use of that support, we could have advanced lesbian leadership of the movement more rapidly and positively. Although I support the woman's lib movement objectively, many lesbians question my lack of activity in the woman's rights area, and my tendency to identify more strongly with the male gay than with women. They are correct in assessing my philosophy. During my life, my greatest enemy was a heterosexual woman who feared the loss of her security and status and reveled in her place on the pedestal. Even though some of my best friends are straight women, that statement says it all. The picture of the lesbian held by the most liberal-minded heterosexual woman of today still stamps many of us as pseudo-males. Just a few days ago, that term was used to me by a friend who has known me for years, and a compliment she was trying to make. Perhaps if I were to become closely involved in some large active group of women's lib, I might, through their consciousness-raising activities, discover more straight women with whom I could identify. But up to now, I have found that those who became most friendly are in search of some advantage or adventurous kick by their association with me.
Unlike Shirley's attitude on the matter, I greatly enjoy the companionship and company of women, even perhaps some of the less enlightened women. You may recall, long before the formation of the Daughters of Bilitis, I had many, many acquaintances among the gay women of New York. For instance, Miss Giddings and I were hiking companions for many years from Delaware through Vermont and had many acquaintances in common. However, I had not, to my knowledge, any acquaintanceship among gay men until introduced to their problem at the New York Mattershine meeting, which also introduced the Daughters of Bilitis. Of course, at that time, I immediately joined Mattershine as a matter of ethical obligation to the homophile movement. Now, surely we were indicating pretty much that the Daughters of Bilitis worked on the assumptions that public fear of the homosexual in society was the most important force working against the lesbian. The Daughters attempted to soothe social fears. They tried to show the homosexual did not pose a social threat. Now, can we claim that this was an essential in process for the success, for the subsequent success of the homophile movement, especially since the new wave of activists took the alternate direction of making the public face its fears and deal with them? Really, the reason for success of the activist approach has not been conclusively explained even to gay forces, which periodically go through agonizing fears of backlash potential. I think we've come to conclude that to be quite effective, the behind-the-scenes network of social interaction and practical bargaining, then to be successful, there must be the noise in the street. One doesn't work without the other. The noise in the street is the guarantee that the dealers can deliver the vote. But what made the people get out of the closet into the street? First, there were the few who were willing to run unreasonable risks, and secondly, a society willing to challenge those few. Some few of the Daughters, Miss Giddings, Miss Willer, and others, were willing to risk. But actually, society backed away from those early confrontations.
when society was willing to confront them rather than evade them, then the activists had their opportunity. And their actions brought together and held together the gay community, that mob which makes the essential noise in the street. So long as society feared to face homosexuality, knowing it only as the love that dared not speak its name or the crime unmentionable in polite discourse, in the press, and otherwise, no issue could be forced. The daughters of Bilitis, however innocently, were probing and seeking that catalyzing event which would assist the uncommitted gay person to assert her gay pride.
Well, Toby, I think we've presented you with a pretty compact package of information. I hope that we've answered your questions satisfactorily. If you have any further questions, let us know. We don't want you to be late with your paper. We hope it's progressing well. I hope also that you will continue to correspond with us. Let us know from time to time the progress that you are making. Oh, if possible, could you send us either a duplicate of these tapes or possibly the tapes themselves when you finished with them? We have disposed of the majority of our written material in the process of moving around the country in the last several years. And this attempt at recollection for you would assist us possibly in any of the future requests we might receive for information. Also, we do not consider any of the information that we have given you on these tapes as particularly private or secret. You have complete freedom, as far as we are concerned, to discuss or to allow any other consultants, such as Barbara and Kay, that you may have, listen to and comment or criticize any of the viewpoints we've expressed here.
Mm-hmm.